like I said, set it to infinite time, but keep an eye on it, because I might talk longer than you should actually be running it. Longer the better, but that die front will travel down the length of the gel, the blue. The reason that you have use a die in there is because the DNA that is traveling through the gel is invisible at the moment. You won't see it at all during the progress. So if you didn't have any indication of how far it is, you could let it run so long that it'll just spill off the other end of the gel. The loading die is a molecule that travels faster than any of the DNA pieces, so you know that it's in the front, it's in the lead. And so as long as that die front is still on the gel, you know that the DNA is behind it. But the longer you run it, the more separation you have, and therefore the better. Just keep an eye on it while I speak. And if it gets very close to the edge, turn off your power or unplug it. All right, now we're doing electrophoresis, and that's a real general technique. It's used for a lot of specific reasons, but what kind of technique is it? It's a technique for what? What does it accomplish, in other words? Right, it's a separation technique. One of several separation techniques that are basic to science. Some others, for instance, are distillation. Centrifugation is a separation technique. Well, electrophoresis is one as well. Electrophoresis separates particles from each other based on what properties of the particles? Size, shape. Size and mass I'm using interchangeably because mass depends on the size. But what else besides size and shape? And the missing one is absolutely required for electrophoresis to work to begin with. What is it? Can't hear any answers.
DNA
is what you're separating. I'm saying what properties of particles matter when it comes to electrophoresis. Yeah, you have to have charge. So it separates particles based on their charge, on their size, and on their shape. And if there is no charge at all, if you have a collection of different kinds of particles, but none of them has any charge to them, electrophoresis is going to be worthless as a technique, because they won't. A totally uncharged particle isn't going to have any tendency to move toward the negative or the positive electrode in an electric field, right? So you have to have a charged particle if you want it to electrophorese. The reason I had you put the comb at the end and make your wells at one end rather than in the middle is because we knew that the stuff we're putting in as our samples in the wells tonight is DNA in all cases. Well, it doesn't matter what the sequence of nucleotides is in a DNA molecule. DNA is always negatively charged. Why is that? What makes all DNA, no matter what you get it from, negatively charged? Well, what are the... DNA is a polymer, right? It's a macromolecule that is a polymer made by stringing together monomers. What are the monomers of DNA? What are the building blocks? Nucleotides. Any individual nucleotide consists of three parts, right? That you learned from 181, hopefully. What are the three components of any nucleotide? A phosphate, a nitrogenous base, and a sugar, a pentose sugar of some sort. Well, phosphate, first of all phosphates are the same as any other phosphate. It's a group, phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms, right? The phosphate group as a whole has charge to it. It's a negative polyatomic ion. Therefore, since every individual nucleotide has a phosphate, every strand of DNA has plenty of negatives on it. And the DNA, regardless of what the C's, T's, A's, and G's are, doesn't matter. It's still a negative molecule overall. And therefore, it's going to move from the negative end to the positive end. That's why you had to put it in so that it's going to travel toward the red end. Otherwise, it would just spill off the short end and you'd be done, but you wouldn't get any results. Now, the reason that you put the gel red in there is so that you can visualize the bands. The bands are the little spots that will appear in each lane corresponding to where your DNA is. So there are different things that affect the mobility. Well, I've already told you things that affect the mobility. It's the size, shape, and the charge. Those are properties of the actual particles. So the smaller a particle, the faster it will move through the gel. If it's more charged, it will have a tendency to move faster. But DNA is equally negative for any DNA, so charge is really not an issue. And therefore, smaller fragments will move the farthest. They'll be farthest away from the well compared to larger pieces of DNA. And this is the... Yeah, go ahead. Well, they have to have charge in order to move at all. If you had a mixture of differently charged particles, the more charged they are, the faster they'll move. But DNA is equally negative, has an equal charge density. Because the bigger it is, the more negatives it has, but it has an equal amount of negatives per size. All right? And the shape matters too, because if you have two identical size particles, you know, imagine walking through a pool, which is kind of analogous to a particle trying to move through this viscous gel. If you're totally underwater, first of all, it's hard as hell to walk through water anyway. But if you spread out your arms and make yourself, you know, you're not changing the size of yourself, you're just changing the shape, it makes it even harder, right? So the shape matters as well. The reason we put the gel red in, though, is because we will not see the DNA bands at all unless we would... One option would be to stain the gels after they're produced. So it would all be invisible. The bands would be there, but you wouldn't see them until you stain the gel. That's something we're not doing, though. Instead, we're using this gel red that becomes part of the gel, and then the DNA will... actually bind wherever it lands. The DNA will bind to the gel red, and the gel red will fluoresce under ultraviolet light. So that's why once you're done, you don't have to bother staining. You just put it in this ultraviolet transilluminator and your bands will glow. So you'll be able to see your results tonight. You don't have to stain them overnight or anything. Okay? So that's the basics of electrophoresis, but the whole reason we are electrophoresing is to determine whether you're heterozygous or homozygous for that ALU DNA, right? And so the broader context of this whole thing is to be able to do your calculations and relate this to Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Have you talked about Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium in the lecture yet? What was the answer to that? You have? So you're already familiar with the basic equations then, right? The most basic equation is what? No, more basic than that. What? Right, P plus Q equals 1. Now, all of this pertains only to Mendelian genetics, as I've described it. Remember what the stipulations for it to be Mendelian are? What were they? It has to be exactly 2 alleles, no more, for whatever characteristic you're studying, and one of them has to completely dominate over the other, right? Those are the 2 biggies. So that's why we have only 2 variables here, P and Q, because there's only 2 possible alleles. If you had more, you would have to use totally different equations that would rapidly become a lot more complicated. So this is a Mendelian thing we're studying here. And it's called Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium because a population that is in Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium is not evolving. It's in equilibrium in the sense that the ratios of the alleles, the allele frequencies as we call them, what fraction of the total number of alleles is the dominant type, what fraction is the recessive type, that is not changing from generation to generation if a population is in equilibrium. Well, that by definition means that that population is not undergoing evolution. It's not undergoing microevolution. So you already know that real populations do evolve, right? And therefore, by showing that a real population violates or does not obey Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, you're showing that it is evolving. Now, what about these assumptions that you have to make for Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium to work? What are those assumptions that are in your handout? One is that you have to have a hell of a big sample size. Really, for it to mathematically be perfect, you have to have an infinite population size. Obviously, no real population is infinite. But it has to be sufficiently big for these numbers not to crumble, basically. All right. Well, so some populations are big enough for it to not be an issue. But if you have a real small population size, this wouldn't apply. What else is assumed? Random mating, which means that of the two phenotypes possible, remember, we're only paying attention to one characteristic at a time. So if we use eye color again as an example, there's only two eye colors possible in this population. And random mating in this sense means that no individual has a preference for eye color when it comes to mating. That's what it means by random. So having, if we say that the two eye colors are blue and red, blue being blue-eyed doesn't give you an advantage or a disadvantage as far as a mate selecting you. All right, that's random mating. What else is assumed? Sorry, I didn't hear you. Right, no migration in either direction. So the population has to be big to begin with, like I already said, but it has to stay that size. So no new individuals are allowed to come in, and no individuals are allowed to leave. Well, you know that in real populations that doesn't happen, right? There is immigration and emigration that happens in real populations, and that's one reason why Hardy-Weinberg isn't really realized in real populations. Anything else? There's another really important one. No mutations. Of course, that's a fairy tale. Mutations exist, right? They happen accidentally all the time. But why would that violate Hardy-Weinberg? Because when you have a mutation, you all of a sudden have a new kind of allele. That's the whole reason that we're not all copies of that original cell that came into being to begin with, right? The whole reason that there is genetic variation and therefore different kinds of species is that there are different kinds of DNA, and the original reason for that is that DNA mutates. If there were only one kind of DNA, it wouldn't matter. I mean, we would all just be identical copies. So, yeah, if mutation occurs, that's a violation as well. But if we pretend all those things that really... And another one is no selection. No selection is happening, but... So, still no advantage of one allele over the other. Well, that's the one that is truly violated most readily in real populations, right? The whole idea that one allele gives you a slight advantage or disadvantage compared to the other allele is the reason natural selection works. If the multiple phenotypes were identical in their ability to allow you to survive long enough to reproduce, then there would be no natural selection. And therefore populations, I mean, we wouldn't have speciation in that case. All right, but P plus Q equals 1 should make perfect sense to you. If you only have two alleles, and P is the fraction of the dominant allele, and Q is the fraction of the total number of alleles that's recessive, then they have to add up to the total, right? So one fraction plus the remaining fraction has to equal one, the whole. The other one that's slightly more complicated is just comes from squaring both sides of this, right? So what's the other one? P squared what? Plus 2pq plus q squared equals what? 1 squared, which is 1. One problem that students have with this when they're first thinking about it is not being able to tell the difference between p by itself and p squared, or similarly for q. You have to consider not actually individuals in a population. You have to imagine just the alleles. And by the way, another assumption is that we're talking about diploid organisms. Not all organisms are diploid, right? So we're talking about sexually reproducing organisms, and they're therefore diploid. So every individual has two alleles, right? For whatever gene you're talking about. One from its father, one from its mother. But if you consider the allele pool for the entire population, ignore the individuals, just think of that total collection of dominant alleles and recessive alleles. Each individual contributes two alleles. It might be two dominants, it might be two recessives, it might be one of each. But when you just consider them as an entire pool, that's what this first equation is all about. Okay? You add them up, you get totality, which is 1. P squared, on the other hand, represents the frequency of homozygous dominant individuals. Not individual alleles, individual organisms. Right? A homozygous, you have to have two alleles to be homozygous dominant, right? Because homozygous means they're both the same. You have to have two to have them both the same. But why does it make sense to call that p squared? Well, if p is your fraction of dominant alleles in this whole pool in the population, think about those individual alleles as being in gametes, right? Gametes are haploid. So if you have a p chance of drawing randomly from the pool and getting a dominant allele, to create a new individual, you have to combine that with another allele from the other gamete. Sperm and egg have to come together, right, for fertilization. So a randomly occurring egg has a P chance of being the dominant allele that it's carrying, and a Q chance of being the recessive version, right? To make a homozygous dominant individual, you have to have a dominant egg get together with a dominant sperm. Well, the sperm has also a P chance of being dominant. So when you do the math involved in figuring out the overall odds of that happening, it would be P times P again, right? If you just think about it in the simplest terms, if it's half and half, P is half and Q is one half, you have a 50% chance or a one half chance of drawing a P egg. You have a one half chance of drawing a P sperm, and therefore you have a one half times one half chance of it being a PP zygote. Right? That's why it's P times P and therefore P squared. But p squared is just one possibility for a dominant phenotype individual, right? Remember, there's in Mendelian genetics, there's two ways to have the dominant phenotype. You can be homozygous dominant, or you can be heterozygous, right? 2pq represents the frequency of heterozygotes in the population. The PQ should make sense to you. For it to be heterozygous zygote, you have to have a one P gamete and the other gamete be a Q gamete, right? The reason it's 2PQ is because there's two ways for that to happen. You can have a P egg and a Q sperm, or a P sperm and a Q egg. Therefore, it's not just PQ, it's PQ times 2. Does that make sense? And then Q squared is just like P squared, only it's the frequency of homozygous recessive individuals. And once again, since those are the only three possibilities, you have to be either homozygous dominant, heterozygous, or homozygous recessive. They all add up to one total, which is one. The whole population. All right? Now, the rest of it is described pretty well, I think, in the packet. Except when you get to doing the statistics part, we're using what's called a chi-square test for goodness of fit, a common statistic that's used for a lot of different things. And so what's the formula for the chi-square statistic? First of all, chi is just a Greek X, right? It's called chi-square test because we use the chi letter as the variable here. Chi-square equals what, though? What's the sigma mean? What does it mean? Sum. Sigma is just a Greek S, so it stands for sum. The sum from 1 to n, however many categories you have. All right? So for n categories, it would be the sum from 1 to n. The sum of what, though? Keep in mind, all I'm asking you to do is read what's in front of you. Observed, which I'm just going to symbolize as O sub I, minus E sub I, or it doesn't matter which way you do it, but if you do it expected minus observed, it would be E sub I minus O sub I, squared over what? Expected, which is E. Alright? The reason I'm using the I subscripts is because you have different categories. And therefore, you have an expected for one category, you have an expected number for another category, and so on. Well, this second equation tells you how many categories you have, right? Or just thinking about Mendelian genetics tells you how many categories you have. It's three categories. There's three possible types of individuals, right? Homozygous dominant, heterozygous, homozygous recessive. So N here would be 3. But this is the general form in case you used it for something else. Now, what we're calculating here when we sum this all up is a number that tells us how much reality deviates from what we expect it to be. In other words, how far are measurements off from what you think they should be based on your assumptions? The expected, of course, is what you calculate they should be. Observed is what you actually have. Well, notice that if you get exactly what you're expecting, then expected minus observed is 0. And therefore, no matter what, if all the numerators are 0, the sum is going to be 0, right? So a 0 chi-square statistic means absolutely spot on what you'd expect. But the higher the number, therefore, the more you deviate from expectation. Well, you don't expect to be, I mean, it's very unlikely to be exactly at 0. So the whole idea of statistics is to divorce yourself from the situation and just let the math take over. In other words, don't be subjective about it and say, I think that's probably significant. You let math be objective and say, if it's above a certain cutoff, then you say it's significantly different from what you'd expect. If it's lower, then it's not significantly different. Okay? In this case, the question would be whether or not the population is actually evolving. In other words, are your P and Q values different from what you would expect them to be in a population that's not evolving and therefore is obeying Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium? All right? Now, why do we square this numerator? Why not just have the difference between them, which is really what we care about? That's part of it, yes. A difference, E sub I minus O sub I, could be a positive number, could be zero if it's perfect, or it could be a negative number, right? Depending on what the values are. For instance, if I have, just written a very simple case, if I have two categories, so it would be N is 2 here, and my expected values for the first one is 2, for the second category is also 2. Alright? But let's say what I actually observe for the first one is 0. Sorry, 1. And what I observe for the second is 3. Right? Well, when you obey this formula, expected minus observed for the first category is 2 minus 1. Right? 2 minus 1 over 2, which is expected. When you add that, then summation is adding, remember, for every category. For the second category, it's 2 minus 3 over 2. Well, 2 minus 1 over 2 is 1 half, right? 2 minus 3 over 2 is negative 1 half. When you add those up, you get 0, right? In other words, the negative deviation counteracts the positive deviation. And what I told you about 0 still applies. If you were to get 0, that would imply that there's absolutely no difference between what you expect and what you actually observed. That's not true, though, right? There is definitely differences. So by squaring the numerators, you force every value to be positive, or strictly speaking, non-negative. If it's 0, it stays 0. But if there is any difference at all between E and O, squaring it will make that value always positive. And therefore, when you add them up, they can't counteract each other. They all have to accumulate. That's the whole reason. Does that all make sense? Okay. That's the major stuff. How far along are your things, by the way? Are they getting? They're nowhere near the end, are they? I just make sure you don't spill them over the edge. All right, so make sure that you pay attention to the fact that your degrees of freedom is fewer than the number of categories, which is written up well in there as well. But doing this problem set, which is required, this is for a grade, and actually this is kind of a big chunk. This is 5% of your grade, right? This whole Hardy-Weinberg thing. Make sure you understand it. If you don't, you know, ask questions about it if you need to, but make sure you take your time and do this well so that you get full points, hopefully. Did I give you a due date for this? It is listed already? On my website or on Ken's? Okay. When is that? When did you say? Is that just the next meeting? I assume you want longer than that. By the way, when is there a test coming up in 181? I know there's other kinds of tests. I mean 182? Okay, I don't want it to interfere with that at all. So what is the date of the meeting after that in here?
The 18th.
Okay.
Next Wednesday.
That's 2 meetings from now? Yeah, that should be, because we're almost at the end of the month. Is that long enough? Or you want to go one more week? I don't want to make it so long that you totally forget about it when it's probably going to be treated on this test, right? Hardy-Weinberg is probably going to be part of this lecture test anyway. So, yeah, let's make it 2 weeks from today. All right? So hand that in as soon as you get here 2 weeks from now, before the quiz, and it'll be on time.
For the 18th?
Is the 18th is a meeting day in here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, is that 3 weeks and not two?
Yeah. That's
okay. Okay, sorry. 3 weeks from today. The 18th, no matter how many weeks it is.
Okay.
February 18th.